clash between the hosts and the holders. Both teams got to stay in France as the Springboks eliminated the home team in a quarterfinal worthy of a final. Welcome to the place where the passes are against the grain. News 24's dedicated daily Rugby World Cup podcast, The Inside Pass. Today, I'm joined by a man I'm frankly surprised is still among the living, given that he was there for the defending champions Springboks' 29-28 win. News 24 senior sports writer Khanyiso Chwaku. I think I mangled that just a little bit, but I think we'll soldier on. Chwaku, how are you doing?
I'm good. How you doing?
You sound like a man who hasn't had any sleep, and I suspect you didn't. Actually, just explain it to someone, because everyone kind of thinks, oh, this man's on holiday, he's chilling and relaxing, you know, he watched this game. But just explain exactly, like, what happens after the final whistle is gone up until basically, you know, the time you finally get to your hotel room and get some sleep.
Well, the longer the short of it, here in Paris, we filed a match report. After filing match report, you then go to the press conference. What transpired is today, Emmanuel Macron, France's president, kept the French guys longer than expected. In the dressing room. So the press conference started, I think, just 25 to 28 minutes later than normal. Understandably so, because they had such a nationally deflating result. So then after that, we had the French press conference, and then from that, the American press conference. We then started to go to the mix zone. We generally have that across all internationals, but in particular South African internationals, players then, in particular players are sent to the media box. Whereas in this case, you go to a particular place where they walk out in the barricaded area towards the bus. So there are some players opera for mixed zones, some aren't. So we did that. So what happened is that because of the delay from Macron, we had a very, very close call with trains, because Saint-Denis is north of Paris. We are east, for example, Hendrik and I stay in the quite deep east of Paris. So all of us had to catch, that's including Yanti Gordon, Percy Young, Temba, some names escaped, but we were proven South African journalists. Except for Adnan. Adnan stays actually close to the stadium, so he was safe. We then had to make sure that we got on the train before they were finished and stations closed. And then we got back here. Yanti Gordon and then they stayed near Gare du Nord, so they got off on the one train and they got off at what is one of Paris' main stations. We had to get off at Gare du Nord, catch another train to Porte de Lilas, which is where we stay. So effectively, that was the trip. So it took us an hour and a half to get from the stadium to here after a match that started at 9 and ended at 5 to 11.
Long story short, you're not on holiday, and when you do get back, you're probably going to need a real holiday. Trucks, just to look at that game, I mean, obviously we'd probably been given a primer by the quarterfinal between New Zealand and Ireland. Obviously, I mean, we've spoken so much about this draw and how it's basically stacked up, you know, the strongest teams in the draw on the same side. Obviously, we'd been primed by that, but I don't think anyone expected a game that arguably rivaled or actually was even more sort of tight than, you know, than the Ireland and New Zealand game.
Yes, I think probably the bigger difference between the games on the weekend in Paris was that where Saturday's game was a bit more of a rugby spectacle because it's two really, really good nations, rugby nations, pitted against the one fighting against the tide of opinion of that they are over the hill as a rugby nation against an Australian rugby nation that still has an inability to win quarterfinals. There was a bigger sense of occasion in that it was an expectant host team against holders who are forever aggrieved. And I think when you look at the quality of the game, one would also see that maybe the Ireland-New Zealand game was better from a quality perspective, but it just didn't have the theatre of the France-South Africa game. I mean, you it was, I mean, the build-up to the atmosphere of the game was actually quite different in that Irish fans are often jolly. They sing whether they win or they lose. The French fans, there was, yes, there's a lot that's happened in the Middle East, and with the historical connections between France and that area, there was a high security contingent. Fans were a bit subdued. Once they got into the ground, it felt like a unopoying at Xhosa, where you can feel the heat rising, the convection heat rising. It became a very hot place to be, a very difficult place to be. When they sang the last part of La Marseillaise, they say, Marshall, Marshall, you could actually feel it at the back of your throat. They realize that this is not a place you want to be if you're not in the right place. And it showed in the first 10 minutes where, for some reason, the box just struggled to stay in the game. I mean, it's not often you see Steven Kittel getting set down, not once, but twice. I mean, the first off, Piatto Mahovuka and Win Antonio. Look, those were destruction boys for ball carrying perspective. But there was a sense that the box was fighting everything and even fighting the waves. You know how useless it is when you're swimming in the ocean. So for the Springboks to come out of that particular game on the right and on the results, considering when you even look at the numbers, the box made 153 tackles. They missed 42 tackles. They were low on ball carries, they were low on meters. But I think what the box did so well, it's also hinting to the column, the summation that you wrote. The box won box-like in that when they got an opportunity, they made a count. On those first three tries, the box had no play, no set play, or something that built them up into the 22. They got into the 22 based on transitions and counter-attacks, and they scored. And they came back with 19 points. And I think that's where the French crowd and the French players actually realized that that game was going to be a bit longer and a bit more strenuous for them than they thought, because they felt with the amount of possession and territory they had, it was a game for them to win. They didn't take it for granted, but they felt that they had the game in the bag. But the box always found that one punch that just put them on the canvas and back, where you see boxes firing with the other boxes landing so many punches. But the one just lands, the one punch that makes the back of your neck shake, your knees just that bit more groggy. And I think that's what the box did. They roped up Brian, if I can put it that way. They just took from Muhammad Ali's playbook, where you take your punches, but you throw that one punch. That reminds your opponent that I'm not quite done yet. And I think that Elizabeth's try was the proper solar plexus punch, where one felt that there was a bit of a dampening in the spirit, because I think for whatever France did, that was the try that just did not simply allow them to come back into the game.
That's exactly the thing about that game. I mean, the scoreline says 29-28, which is pretty blatant. You know, it was close. It still, in a funny way, felt even more sort of, in terms of the margin, it still felt even more anorexic, if I should call it that. And that, you know, what kept it to that, or what made it that way, because the Springboks were beaten in practically every single stat except the final score. There were obviously moments that the Springboks built up on in terms of where, you know, they kind of, as Sia put it, chased lost causes. Which ones stood out for you throughout the game? And I know this was an incident-filled game.
Look, the first one was, they built up in a sequence, now that you actually say that. They, I mean, Kirtley's chase on another day is, you run and you chase, you look at the reaction. From the catcher, Gail Siku, when he actually went up for that ball, he didn't keep his eye on the ball when he just made a clean take. It's a tackle, the ball is recycled, France get out of the 22. No, he didn't keep his eye on the ball. Chase lost calls, the ball bounced off his chest, quickly there, snaps it up, it's a try. And then France go back and score after South Africa had actually scored. I mean, even Damien Diallo, his chase from the high ball. Cameron Walkie, 9 out of 10, he catches the one. But chase pressure. Are you chasing the ball, chasing a lost cause? It looks like a lost cause, but the ball's in the air. It's a contestable. The box in for the contestable. Walking didn't catch the ball. Devin Dialende, snaffle, takes the ball up, phases. Get caught from Reinach's side. Nothing that the box did tactically got them to that point. But there are two moments where they were able to get out in 22 put the ball up in the air. It looks like a lost call from the one side, but the box took then half a loaf. And actually, they took two fishes and five loaves and fed themselves for 1,000, for 5,000 people. They led 12-5.
Trucks, so I'll do you. I'll do you one better. And basically say to you, they literally built a bakery from the crumbs they were getting in the game.
Exactly. That's what they did. The charge down will go down as the legend, because Tilden Cobalt, everyone had a bit of a chat. He just moved to the side, kept his eye on Thomas Ramos. He looked at the shot clock, and then actually went for it. But Nan was actually saying next to like, this guy looks like he's going to make it. And probably when the ball came off his arm, there was the silence for the kicker. The disbelief in the French fans was palpable. They were surprised. And there was a slight whistle where they felt that maybe it was illegal. Then they realized that actually that was within the law. And then the man in which the box then ran to the halfway line, they felt that that was a turning point in the game. And I think those 2 points in the long run actually mattered. Yes, from a penalty that Ramos missed later in the half, the box then went and scored, building up well. So there was, I think, that particular charge that, but I think also the brazenness of the box to go for that particular crash ball move, where there was a feeling that they were 25-19 down, they should have gone for the corner, or they should have gone for the penalty, 3 points. No, they backed themselves. We asked Jacques about it. This is something that you often see in club rugby, but they practice it, but they actually don't often improvise it to do it in the match. But they went through that process. That was probably a 50-50 call from them, but it paid off because they trusted that process. They stuck to that French defense so well, because you now had a point where Eben ran at two backs in the forward, just cut in between them. And that particular door that was opened by the box force, just sucking enough of those French forwards, was enough for Eben to score. So again, goes back to the crumbs opening up a bakery, and the box fans are having a problem with work this morning, along with croissants. Whereas for France now, well, it is what it is.
Jeez, good thing you're not rubbing it in. Obviously, I mean, you've mentioned obviously in the moments that sort of did it for you. The one thing in the first half was, you know, the box were very much alive to their opportunities. You know, first three cases of transition and three tries, which hasn't been the case all tournament. But in a way, they kind of did, you know, the team did what it was picked to do, because this team, you know, the team that was picked to start, it was picked to wreck on the points. And then obviously, you know, the bench was picked to come and sort of, you know, secure things. Talk me through how you feel that when you look at the stats, you know, in the end, in terms of who they favor, talk me through how you feel sort of the boxes, selections and tactics went against, you know, the stats and outcomes.
5-3, the 5-3 bench first and foremost was always going to be confusing, considering what the objectives were, what France's objectives were first. But the key part, the box had 5 forwards, but their 5 forwards were far superior than France's 6 in the longer run of the second half. They were absolutely amazing. But I think what caught me by surprise was the manner in which France contained control and actually dominated parts of the game. One of the thoughts that whereas the boxers starting 15 was there to actually grab the game by the scruff of the neck, it was one of those games where they were absolutely held down by the collar and given absolutely no room to breathe. I mean, it's not often that you see Dwayne Femunin's carries being static, Peter Steph's carries. Because, I mean, Sia Polisi spent the bulk of that first half having to make tackle after tackle after tackle. It's not often you see him being so ineffectual in the carry. I mean, even Esabeth, when he made a few of those first half carries, one felt that the box were actually up against the game. But I think what the box did, and they did so effectively, was that in taking the hit from the French front row, who were clearly the France's main ball carriers, that being Mao Fuka, Cyril Bai, and Owen Antonio, they doused France's five, because the longer they forced them to carry, the more they sacked them of energy. But, and the box were very happy to, this is something as all that. They were very happy to get them gain meters, but they put in the hard hits consistently. I think that, I think we're probably, I think as I referred to a bit earlier, we saw Stephen Kitsoff being hit backwards. It's one of those many battles the box always talk about. They lost a fair few of those many battles, but in putting together the pieces of that win, they, once they were able to tire out Francis' ball carriers, there was a staleness in Francis' carry in the second half. I actually mentioned this to Jan de Koning after the game, where Cameron Wauke was so effective with his secondary carries because of the momentum he gained from the front row making the carries. There was none of that in the second half because he was now the stationary first carrier, the same being applicable to Thibaut Flamin. When Romain Tafanua actually came on as their main ball carrier in the second half, they didn't quite carry the same punch as Francis' first main front row. And I think what the box did was that instead of actually racking up the points, which they did through the minimal opportunities that they used, the ability to absorb pressure was magnificent. And I think, it goes back to the smart use of the bench. And I think this is where South Africa and New Zealand got it right. Their split benches where you have younger finishers, but you also have your cool hit came through. I mean, if you look at Sam White, your catch turnover. I mean, that's what you expect from a player in 151 caps. I mean, you look at a player like Waka Smith, who's never been a surefire starter in the team, but he's generally always been there and they're about to help finish a game, and he's been explosive on the pitch for the Springboks. The Boxers' bench, as much as it was much maligned for its composition, was the one that actually pulled the box through and made the key decisions, where you fought with Ireland and France. Because of them wanting to send a early group statement, didn't quite have the necessary armory to see a game through. And I mean, what the Boxers and New Zealand showed in this weekend, regardless of what the state of Southern Hemisphere rugby is, you need to play the full 80 minutes in a knockout game, and that's what they exactly did.
Just looking at the team that the Boxers selected, obviously they selected a team to boss the gain line either side of the ball, obviously with ball in hand and in defense. Too often through the game, I felt that wasn't happening because it felt like the French were bossing the collisions. And then obviously they picked a team to nullify the French lineout. Didn't happen. They seemed quite comfortable on their own ball, and frankly they were able to contest what the box got up to as well. And then obviously there was the ruck, where the ball was insanely quick, which is why they were chasing shadows for the vast majority of, say, the first 50 minutes, if I should call it that. Is there sort of cause for us to be concerned looking forward in terms of the tournament, or was it a simple case of having run into a team that kind of asked questions that aren't normally asked of the Springboks?
It's a bit of both, because I think on another day, as much as England are also quite much maligned, England are probably masters of turning pressure to points from anywhere in the field. Whereas where France looks for maximum impact in terms of getting in the 22 and scoring points, England are happy scoring points from anywhere in the field. If they've got a penalty on the 10-meter line, they take three. And that's how pretty much they are next to Mathieu Reynolds, very one-sided officiating. That's effectively how they got on the group stage. England take whatever points they are on offer. So, yeah, and England may not have as quick a rack speed as France, as quick a rack speed as Ireland. But again, you don't want to create point scoring opportunities for visitors. You don't allow a team to build an inning. Where the Boxers have been rather fortunate in that in facing Ireland and France, both teams were happy to go for the five instead of the three. Whereas if you now commit three mistakes against England in 8 minutes, England are going to lead 9-0 because they don't worry about the end point of getting tries. They just want points. They just want to pull the inning. So I think what the box need to do is just actually eliminate that particular right speed and make sure that they try to play as much rugby on the right side of the field, because in the two games against Ireland and France, the lineout was nullified because of the particular kicking games of the team and the low error rate we saw from Ireland and France, where I mean, the Springboks only had four lineouts of their own, and which they won all of them, and with quite a difficulty with which they did. In the Ireland game, they only really got Rowley Moore going in the 68th minute, which was tactically smart from Ireland. So England would have taken note of that. And I mean, they were probably the one team that felt the brunt of the box forwards when they were beating and tricking them last year. And they most probably will have learned from that game and tried to make sure that they avoid allowing the Springboks getting a foothold in the game. But that particular team selection, again, I don't think England have the bruising ball carriers. I suspect that they may want to give a Billy Vunipola a run because probably one of the few forwards who is actually able to ask questions, again, like questions against the box, but also the box are the one team that has continually properly shut the door and whether he plays even for the British and Irish Lions. So, look, I mean, the box also don't want to allow England to have the same foothold that France had through their game because England do play a point game that allows them to build an innings. Because that building of an inning allowed them to stay abreast of Fiji, even though Fiji were comfortably the better team in the second half in Marseille, isn't it?
Of course, usually this is a feeling we've all but patented in South Africa, you know, Operation Blame the Ref. For once, the shoe was on the other foot with the French, basically saying that, you know, this was an easy game for them to win, obviously given their dominance, had they gotten, you know, the calls that they needed, you know, from referee Ben O'Keefe. What do you make of that? And I'm asking that almost specifically from the perspective of, if you start booing the ref in the first minute of the game, are you really expecting him to, you know, to come bearing gifts?
Far from it. Referees are human beings. Referees have emotions. They, even though they need to take the emotions out of their work and out of the occasion, I mean, from the get-go, France were contesting almost every decision. Whereas the box were happy to try take the game, let the crowd shout it for us. I mean, he was spot on with the EMA, let the best decision. One, the yellow card, whichever way you look at it, was a correct one. There was climbing to the head, even though his arm did wrap. Even being the taller player, it's always going to be in a problematic position. But that knockdown, he was actively going. I think the bounce of the ball, probably again one of those small turning points, actually helped because the ball then bounced backwards. Had it gone forward, I think the call would have been different. But explain that to a crowd that has never seen or a country that's never won a Rugby World Cup playoff in Paris. For them, they need all of those particular things, bounce off the ball, to go the way. And I think also because they're very accustomed to putting referees under pressure, they sometimes don't understand when a referee makes a right decision, whether it impacts them from a negative perspective. Because, I mean, the scum calls, they were not happy. I mean, for them, teams come here and they play in basic Champions Cup rugby. I mean, the Irish were the first to complain on behalf of the Springboks after Marseille's game and said what the Springboks actually experience in Marseille is what they experience on a regular when they come play European rugby, where particular replays aren't available and the screens won't work when a decision needs to go against the French team. But when the opposition team's under pressure, there's multiple angles for the referee to choose from. So I think the neutrality of the World Cup, wants to feel that there was neutrality. I think there was. It effectively equalized it because now the referee isn't subject to the whims of a particular organizing body. They're subject to the whims of world rugby. And I think it kind of equalized it in the sense where France had dominance. They expected the dominance to be rewarded. It wasn't the first stop. But I think once the box, Turukwakasis in particular, when they were able to slow the ball down, I mean, France then got upset by every decision because they felt that maybe that slowing down of the ball was illegal, especially when Dwayne Tremulin came back on. I mean, that France rack speed slowed significantly, and that actually allowed the box to put on. I mean, Damien Phillips' appreciation for the laws in calling for a scrum when he took a mark. The French crowd was absolutely incensed. They were insanely. But again, what it also helped to actually just help the French fans shout themselves hoarse. But on the other hand, it actually helped dim the situation because the box were chasing shadows again at the time. But it helped slow the game down significantly and then into the box's favor.
Trucks, last question. I found it quite interesting listening to the press conference afterwards. Obviously, you know, the bent of the French questions was basically, you know, it was almost like listening to Rafa Benitez talk about facts, you know, from all those years ago, you know, basically outlining all these incidents. And then the interesting thing that they asked of Jacques was kind of like, I mean, it wasn't asked directly, but the implication was that the HIA tests were basically, you know, were basically used to almost as rolling subs to, you know, for those players that went off. I think it was Peter Steph Dutoit and Mwangi Mbonambi to basically get, like, you know, to get a breather and get back onto the park. But the real truth is, while we could talk about or debate the French calls, we couldn't exactly do the same with the you know, with the South African sort of head clash calls, simply because there was no replays. Is that going to be a problem going forward, or, you know, was that the last time it was going to happen, simply because, you know, it was the home team?
Yeah, I think because of the home team, more than anything else. I mean, I actually watched on a different team, the TF1, on the TF1 stream on my laptop to check for replays. Look, they replayed the Peter Steph toy one. Quite regularly they replayed even Zwan. I mean, they replayed it on the screen. I think they replayed it 5 times, and with every replay, the fever pitch just went higher and higher. If you measure that in body temperature, it goes past 40 degrees and one lands up in Oslo. That's how feverish the fans. But look, I mean, again, you need to look at one. Jacques mentioned that they needed to look after the thing. The safety of the players, because Peter Steph Dutoit, after his head clash, he stayed down for a while. It wasn't a belated thing. He stayed, I mean, I think there were 3-4 phases of play after that he joined, and he kind of didn't look in the greatest of shape. Even then, there was consultation with the match officials at the bottom, where, are you going for HIA? And Dr. Jerome Mampane was quick to say yes, well, there was a head clash there, so we are well within our rules, actually checking if there was a head clash. So look, if the rules allow them to do that, I mean, the one thing that Rice Erasmus does well is to look at the rules, what the rules allow to do, what the rules don't allow him to do. And that's what effectively he did. I mean, if they noticed that there's a head clash and they felt that a player needed to get medical attention, I think they felt that they were well within their rights, because I think the last thing that World Rugby would have wanted to deal with is that the box feels that there was a head clash. The games went, chief medical officers know there wasn't a head clash, and then 2 days later, a player then signals that I'm concussed and now can't play for 2 weeks to follow the HIA protocol. So it's a fine line that was treaded. Jacques explained that they needed to put the players' medical safety first, and I think one can't dispute past that.
Trucks, in that game, you know, 80 minutes couldn't decide. You know, it still left us with all sorts of debates and all sorts of things to unpack. I'm pretty sure we're not going to do it in a 30-minute podcast, so we're going to have to leave it there for now. But obviously, you know, long story short, you know, the Springboks are through to the semifinals. They've got England on Saturday. And in case you're interested, on the other side of the draw, New Zealand play against Argentina on Friday, if I'm not mistaken. And the really interesting thing there is, you know, I think the big question marks are whether South Africa and New Zealand expended too much energy to the point where there might be a threat of losing to what everyone considers to be inferior opposition. That's it from us today. We'll pick up this thread again tomorrow.